Consistent with our pattern of kind of being one parsha behind, I want to talk a little bit about Parshas Kitzavé. Again, we have a certain amount of freedom here because so many parshios are about the Mishkan, so we can kind of mix and match, and we're still within the area that's being discussed. And that is, Parshas Truma gave us the schematic architectural design of the Mishkan, right, in terms of the various structures of the Mishkan, the tent of the Mishkan, the courtyard, the outer altar, which is a very big mizbeach where they brought korbanos, and then inside the building of the Mishkan, we have the menorah and the shulchan and the golden altar for incense, and then you have the Kodesh HaKadoshim, which has the Aron, right? We talked about all of that, and the like. And the Mishkan was disassembled and carried from place to place and then reassembled. So it's very unique. It was a portable Beis HaMikdash. Very, very unique idea that unlike the Beis HaMikdash that is in one place, the Mishkan moved with us and the like. Now, Parshas Tetzave talks about, largely, the begadim, the garments that the Kohen has to wear. Now again, you've gone over the basic psukim, but just to be sure that the people understand, basically, a regular Kohen had four garments that he wore, and the Kohen Gadol had eight garments that he wore. And the garments of a regular Kohen are pure linen, plain white linen. The garments of the Kohen Gadol are much more elaborate. Now it's interesting though to keep in mind that on Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol actually wore, some times of the day he wore the eight garments, and sometimes he wore the four garments. So in some ways he would go back and forth. And when he went into the Holy of Holies, he just wore the plain white garments as a sign of purity and the like. Now, what are the four garments of a regular Kohen? So there is kind of an undergarment, kind of pants, which are called michnasayim. And then there is a robe, which is kind of like a long nightshirt. Imagine the old nightshirts people used to wear that go all the way down to the ankles. And then there's an avnet, which is a girdle, a belt that went around his body, his waist. Actually, it was fairly high. It was actually all the way up here many, many times. And then there is migbas, which is a hat, okay, a cap. Usually it was a peaked cap. So we have the cap, we have the avnet, we have the kasones, which is the long nightshirt, not nightshirt, but the long robe. And then we have the michnasayim, which is under his garments. Now these garments are kadosh, and they can only be worn while the temple service was going on, meaning... Is it coming from here? Okay. All right. Okay. Yeah. All right. So they can only be worn bishas avoda during the service itself. Now, meaning the Kohen had to take it off right after the service because it was kadosh. So when you showed up to the Beis HaMikdash every morning to do the avoda, you came in your own clothes, and then you would switch to the big day kahuna in order to do the avoda. Now, one thing you need to know about Big Day Kahuna, and that is, they are an absolute condition to the validity of the sacrifices. If a Kohen brought a sacrifice without wearing the Big Day Kahuna, the whole sacrifice is invalid. It is not just an adornment. You have to wear the uniform. Now, I can give you a whole shmooz. I don't want to really go there so much. People talk about why is it so important, you know, to wear a jacket or wear a hat or whatever it is. So people like to draw analogies. Well, you see how important the uniform is to identify you as what team you belong to, so to speak. So people draw analogies to all matters of Levush, but we don't have to emphasize that point right now. Now, another thing to keep in mind is the same way if a Kohen is missing some garments, the sacrifices are invalid. If he wears an extra garment, the whole sacrificial rite is invalid. If it's a cold day and he wore a sweater, no good. If he decided to have a nice decorative scarf, no good. If he wore shoes or socks, no good. He had to walk barefoot outside. No, in the temple courtyard, that's where the korbanos were brought. Same thing is true in the Beis HaMikdash. Same thing happened there as well. That's why it mentions that Kohanim often had digestive problems. Why was that so? Because even in the rain and the cold, they have to do the temple service in the big day kahuna with no coat, no sweater, and no shoes, no socks. And then they had to eat heavy meat of korbanos. So you combine the heavy diet and being out in the cold and the wet, so you know you can get digestive problems that way and the like. So it was not always so easy to be a kohen. Although, ponder this. Okay, in the Midbar, at the beginning of the Midbar, when the Mishkan was built, how many kohanim are there? There actually are not that many. There's only Aaron, and Aaron had four sons. But you'll recall, we're not there yet, but two of those sons died the day the Mishkan was dedicated. So really, there's only three Kohanim. Aaron, Elazar and Isamar, and then later Pinchas, who was Elazar's son, joined them. So there are not a lot of Kohanim. Now that means, of course, if there's not a lot of Kohanim, then every Kohen had to do a lot of stuff. All the Karbanos were brought only by three Kohanim. But in the course of time, during the first temple and the second temple, there were thousands of Kohanim. So, just to understand the process, if you were a Kohen during the Beis HaMikdash, you know, years later, and let's say there are thousands of Kohanim, how often would you be doing service in the Beis HaMikdash? Was it like, you know, whenever I showed up, I just said, hey, I'd like to do Karbanos today? So it actually didn't work that way. The way it worked was, the Kohanim were divided into 24 family units. And these are called Mishmor. Mishmor meant a watch. 24 family units. And every week, the service was given to that family, to that Mishmor. And the Mishmor, in turn, divided itself into six units. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And then on Shabbos, the entire Mishmor would come. Now, a Mishmor is not a small unit. If you consider the fact, I mean, I don't have an exact numbers, but let's assume there were 50,000 Kohanim during the temple period. So divide 50,000 by 24. You're still dealing with a very, very large group. So the subdivisions for every day of the week is called Beis Av. So every Mishmor had six Batei Avot, which would mean on any single day there would be several hundred Kohanim who would report for active duty in the Beis HaMikdash. And then they would draw lots to determine which Kohanim got to do something. So even if you were, you know, this was your Mishmor, and even if Sunday was your Beis Av, that didn't mean you did anything. It's like, jury duty. I don't know if any of you ever went to jury, right? You kind of show up. Actually, there you're lucky. And if you're lucky, you know, you don't get called and you go home. You know, sometimes you might be stuck with a murder trial and, you know, be sequestered for 3 weeks. You know, you don't want to do that. But here is the opposite. You show up to do service in the Beis HaMikdash, and you may not get the job at all, because there were always more Kohanim than there were things to be done. Now, since a week has 52 weeks, so the Mishmor cycle went through two complete cycles, 48 plus a remainder, but then they would start again. Now, the only exception is for the three pilgrimage festivals, Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkot, and if you learn the end of Masechah Sukkah, you know this, all 24 Mishmaras showed up, 50,000 Kohanim showed up. And then they had to divide it, not just among 1,000 or 2,000. They had to divide the service among 50,000. And then, of course, the vast majority didn't have any chelik at all. Which means, the point I want to make is, it's entirely possible that a Kohen might almost never get a chance to do avodah in the temple. Because the Mishmor system, the Beis Av system, the many Kohanim that came for the Shalosh Regalim, and the like. Or, at most, maybe once or twice a year, you slaughtered a korban, or you sprinkled the blood of one korban. You see, it was not like you would think that a Kohen was a full-time job. I mean, you showed up to the Mikdash a few times a year. Maybe you got something to do, maybe you didn't. You weren't allowed to drink wine during your week of active duty because maybe you'll be needed. And if a Kohen drank wine, he could not do the Avodah. But there was a lot of waiting around. Now, the Or Samech, the Mesher Chochmah, makes a very interesting point. The Torah says that Kohanim and Levim are not allowed to own land in Eretz Yisrael because they have to focus on serving Hashem. But what do you mean, serving Hashem? I mean, maybe if you're a Kohen, you slaughtered one animal a year. So the Mesher Chochmah says, you see from here a very important lesson, that to properly serve Hashem, it may sometimes take an entire year of preparation just to serve Hashem properly for 2 minutes. That, yeah, you need a year of learning, a year of davening, a year of musar, a year of tikkun hamidah, just to have one authentic moment of closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We think, hey, if I'm only going to slaughter one animal a year, so, you know, 10 minutes before I do it, you know, I'll meditate a little bit. No, you need the whole year to be free of earthly concerns. And, you know, this is why, even for davening, Chazal advise that one should set aside some time before davening to think about tefillah. Right? Remember the Mishnah mentions that there were Chasidim HaRishonim. There were the early pious generations that they would contemplate davening 1 hour before davening. So that's what does it say? It says they would think about, they would meditate 1 hour before prayer. They would daven for an hour, and then they would meditate after prayer. So that means 9 hours a day they spent davening. Right? Pre-davening meditation, davening, and then post-davening meditation. And the Gemara even asks, if they daven 9 hours a day, how are they going to learn? How is their Torah going to be accomplished with so much davening? And the Gemara says that because of their Yiras Shemayim and because of their connection with Hashem, Hashem gave them unusual blessed success in their learning, even though it was for fewer hours, that they were able to accomplish in less time what would take normally much more time. Okay, so this is something to be aware of, the Mishmor system. And the Gemara even says in Tainus, now again, no Kohen knows this today, that if you're a Kohen and you happen to know what Mishmor you belong to, now the truth is there is no way of knowing that knowledge today, but you would know that this is the week of my Mishmor. This is the week that if there's a Beis HaMikdash, I would be on call. He says you're not allowed to drink wine that day. Because maybe the Beis HaMikdash gets built today. And you're the guy that's going to have to bring the Korban Tumah. So if you know your Mishmor, you don't drink. Well, if you know, it depends. It's a little more complicated. If you know your Mishmor, you don't drink wine the entire week.
Even on Shabbos?
So Shabbos you would, because the mitzvah of Kiddush, so we can't allow this to override that, but you wouldn't drink extra. Now, if you knew your Beis Av, which means you knew your subdivision, and we don't even have records of this, and you knew that your subdivision was on for Sunday, then only Sunday you wouldn't drink wine. You could drink wine on Monday. But again, I mean, you see, there's no way we have access to any of this information. No Kohen really knows his Mishmar. If you knew your Mishmar, we have no record of the Batei Avos, of the individual subcomponents for every day. But in the time of the Brisa, this is a Brisa, some of this information was still known to people. And therefore there were actually days of the year in which we have to be choshesh, in a good way, that the temple is going to be rebuilt today. And if this is my potential day, I don't drink wine that day, because maybe it's going to be my turn to do Avodah. In a way, that's such a vivid expression of belief in Geula, belief in Mashiach, that you say, I can't drink today because, you know, maybe we'll have the Beis HaMikdash in the afternoon, and then I'm going to have to do some service in the temple. Yeah.
Does that mean a Kohen that owns land nowadays, when the third Beis HaMikdash gets built, he has to sell his land?
Well, here's the thing. In truth, a Kohen is allowed to own land by purchase. In other words, the Torah just says he doesn't get a share in the land. But if he buys land, he is the owner, but he gives back the land in Yovel, the Jubilee year. So what's going to happen is that in the Jubilee it'll go back, but in the meantime he's allowed to own that land. Yeah.
What if the day of his of the Kohen serving the Beis HaMikdash was the 15th of Adar? But nowadays, then there wasn't.
Because of Purim?
Yeah, Purim.
No, well, he can't. Drinking on Purim is at most a rabbinic law. So being ready for the service would override that. In other words,
it's kind of good. It's kind of, if they knew, then they wouldn't be able to do that mitzvah.
Okay, well, all right, so there are certain advantages to ignorance. I agree. Sometimes maybe it's better not to know, and that way you can drink. In fact, the Gemara even asks as a Havamina, that, if a Kohen doesn't know his Mishmar, like all Kohanim today, then maybe he should never be able to drink, because maybe the temple will be rebuilt and it happens to be his Mishmar. So the Gemara's maskana is that we're not afraid of that. If you don't know your Mishmar, you don't have to assume today is my day. But the Gemara actually had a Havamina that a Kohen should never be able to drink, because maybe it'll be the day of his Mishra. Okay, but yeah.
I was wondering what, parallel to the way when somebody doesn't know where Shabbos is, if they're lost in the desert, they're expected to pick a day and then count 7 days.
Count 7 days, right.
Why would a Kohen not then maybe be obligated to pick 2 weeks, so that they could surely figure out what the calculation would be, how often you would be on call?
Well, the truth of the matter is that the Chachamim, this was a Chumrah anyway, because you're not mechuyev to automatically assume that the temple will be built today, and you're not mechuyev to automatically assume that I'm going to get a position today. Remember, even if all the cards line up, even if this was your Mishmar, and even if this was your Beis Av, it was likely that you wouldn't get the position, because there were normally hundreds of Kohanim every day, and there were fewer than hundreds, the Korbanos were less. Right? So the Chachamim didn't want to be overly machmer on this. The Chachamim didn't want to take away your normal ability to function. Drinking wine was considered to be a very normal thing that people did. So they weren't overly machmer in this, but they wanted to give this kind of reminder of the Geula. Now, when we come to the Kohen Gadol, the Kohen Gadol has 8 garments, his full uniform. Now, 4 of them are the same, with one very important distinction. The Kohen had the Michnasayim, he had the undergarment, same as regular Kohen. The Kohen had the, what you call the nightshirt, the kasonis, same as regular Kohen. The Kohen had a cap, same as regular Kohen, but it was shaped a little different, meaning instead of being tall, it went out a little bit, like the turbans and the like. And the Kohen had a belt, an avnet, just like a regular Kohen. But here there's a very important distinction. The avnet of the Kohen Gadol, the gartel, the belt, was wool and linen. It actually was shatnas. It was shatnas. Quite amazing. That the normal prohibition of wool and linen, which is allowed in the Torah, you don't wear garments of wool and linen, kalayim, shatnas, is actually considered to be permissible, and not only permissible, but it is mandatory in the Big Day Kahuna, as if to say that in the Beis HaMikdash everything gets elevated and sanctified. So even the woolen linen, again, woolen linen, just to go back a little bit without getting into that, woolen linen is a chok. We don't fully understand what's going on. But the Zohar says that the shayrish, the root of not mixing woolen linen, harkens back to the struggle of Cain and Hevel. If you remember, Cain brought his sacrifice to God from the vegetative, and Hevel brought his sacrifice to God from sheep. And Cain and Hevel represented hatred, sinas chinam, murder, violence. And therefore, when we mix wool and linen, right, linen is a plant, right? So linen is, we don't call it a vegetable, it's not an edible vegetable, although some people eat flaxseed and the like. But the vegetative is the pishtan, the linen, and the animal, the wool, is the sheep. And therefore, we separate wool and linen as if to say, we've got to separate these brothers here because they cause machlokas, hatred, murder. But the Beis HaMikdash is the place of reconciliation. The Mishkan, the Beis HaMikdash, reconciliation, shalom, in which even the brothers who hated each other can come together potentially in love and peace. And that is part of the message of why the Avnet, as well as some other garments of the Kohen Gadol, actually do have the combination of wool and linen, because that represents the harmonization of Cain and Hevel, that the dueling brothers can come together. That is why, of course, to take it a little further, when there is hatred among Jews, we lose the Beis HaMikdash, because the Beis HaMikdash is the place which is the antidote for Sinas Chinam. But when the cancer of Sinas Chinam exists, we don't merit the temple. And that is why Chazal say that the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam. Okay, so that's a far afield, but that's a thought. So four of the garments are exactly the same, with the exception that the Kohen Gadol's belt was shatnez. What are the four additional garments that he wears? So he wears a me'il. Now me'il resembles, if you've seen a picture, it resembles like a long talus katan, let's say, without sitches though, a long talus katan, a four-cornered garment that he would put over his head. It was open on the sides, but it was hanging down in front and in back. And at its rim, its bottom rim, there were bells that would ring, and they would make a noise as he would enter and leave the Beis HaMikdash. That's the me'il. And then there is the ephod. The ephod is like an apron that is belted in the front with shoulder straps. Right, that's the ephod. And then there is the choshen, the breastplate that has 12 jewels with the tribes of Bnei Yisrael. That's called the choshen. So we mentioned me'il, choshen, ephod. And then there's the tzitz, a gold plate on his forehead under the mitznefes that has the words engraved, Kodesh Lashem, holy to Hashem, Yudke Vavke, the Shem HaMefurash. These are the eight begadim of a Kohen Gadol. Now Chazal points out that these garments themselves had a sacrificial function. They atoned for specific sins. The kesonis, the michnasayim, the undergarment, which covers the genitals, effected a kapara for forbidden sexual relations. The kesonis, the nightshirt, I call it the nightshirt, you know, the thing that looked like a closed nightshirt, that is a kapara for murder, because you find by Yosef, they dipped the kesonis in blood, saying that Yosef was destroyed. They used the kesonis to essentially claim that Yosef was murdered. The kesonis is a kapara for murder. The ephod, the apron, so to speak, is a kapara for avodah zarah, idolatry. The Choshen, which is called the breastplate of judgment, is a kapara for perversion of judgment, if judges do not properly adjudicate. Right? So there's a kapara for all of this. The Me'il, which had its bells, was a kapara for Lashon Hara, because Lashon Hara is a sin of the voice. Here you use sound for good purposes. Right? So there's a kapara for all of these different things and the like. Now, so again, so the way Chazal describe it, Chazal give two expressions for the Kohen Gadol's garments. Sometimes they are called Shemona Begadim, the eight garments. And sometimes they are called Big Day Zahav, the golden garments, because in the ephod and the like, there was gold thread that was mixed in. Besides the shatness, there was gold thread. The Kohen Hedjot's garments, Hedjot means the regular Kohen's garments, are either called the Arba Begadim, the four garments, or they're called Big Day Lavan. Right, so these terms are interchangeable. Kohen Hedjot, Big Day Lavan Arba'a Begadim, Kohen Gadol, Big Day Zahav Shemona Begadim. Now, Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol changed his garments five times, and he would go constantly from the white garments to the gold garments, the white garments to the gold garments, etc. Five times. Whenever he went into the Holy of Holies, he would wear the white garments. When he walked out of the Holy of Holies, he would go back to the gold garments, right? So on Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol wore both uniforms. But during the year, the Kohen Gadol wore the eight garments. Okay? So that's kind of the Big Day Kahuna in short. But what I want to talk about, we have time to talk about it today, is specifically, I want to talk about the Choshen, the breastplate. Now, it's interesting that the breastplate was not really a plate. When you hear the word plate, you think of it as metal. The breastplate was not metal. It was embroidery with gold, silver, tefillos. It was embroidered, but it was a thick embroidery. And in that embroidery, there were settings for 12 jewels. And the 12 jewels were in four rows of three. Four rows of three. Okay, so imagine a heavy embroidery, it was not a plate, a heavy embroidery with settings for those 12 jewels. Yeah.
Was it an embroidery on the ephod?
No, the way it works is this. The ephod itself is embroidered, and the ephod is an apron-like thing that it covers him from the back totally, and it's tied in the front. And then there are hooks, right? And the ephod has shoulder straps that go all the way up here. And then there are hooks from the shoulder straps which connect the ephod and the embroidered choshen, which is a separate piece. And the hooks are from the shoulder strap to the choshen. And then at the bottom of the choshen, there is a hole where you insert a psil techeles, a little cord of techeles that ties it to the belt of the ephod. Right? You understand? So the choshen is connected to the top of the ephod through golden hooks, and it is connected to the bottom of the ephod by a seal techeles, by a cord of blue wool that is dyed, and the choshen is supposed to remain connected to the ephod. In other words, you're not allowed to have it flapping, but it is two separate pieces. There is the ephod, and there's the ephod that's the apron, and then there is the choshen. Now, on the Choshen, on the stones of the Choshen, the jewels of the Choshen, we have the names of all the tribes. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zebulun, etc. And because it's 12 tribes and we're counting Levi, we don't count Ephraim and Manasseh. We have Yosef. See, that's a recurring problem. When you don't count Levi, your 12 tribes are Ephraim and Manasseh, counts for two. When you count Levi, you just have one tribe that's called Shevet Yosef. Now, one thing to remember, though, is that there are two different parts of the Kohen Gadol's uniform that has the 12 tribes. On his shoulder, really on top of the ephod, there are two onyx stones. Now, onyx is a black jewel. And on the onyx stones, there are six tribes on one stone and six tribes on another stone. They are called Avnei Shoham. Shoham just means onyx. But then, you have 12 jewels in the Choshen that are called Avnei Choshen or Avnei Miluim, these stones that fill the settings. Miluim is the settings, in which you also have the 12 tribes. So one thing to think about, again, we'll continue this discussion, is there is this concept that when the Kohen Gadol enters the Beis HaMikdash, the tribes of Israel must be in his heart. That's what the Torah says. He shall carry them on his heart. But you understand the meaning. Physically placing them over his heart is also referring to emotionally. In order for him to be the leader of Am Yisrael, he has to love his people. When he doesn't have them in his heart when he serves God, then he's not able to be the Kohen Gadol. But that explains spiritually the message of the Avnei Miluim. But it doesn't explain the onyx stones, right? What function spiritually do the onyx stones serve in addition to the Avnei Choshen? Yeah.
Do we say there's 12 or 13 tribes, like generally? What Shevet Yosef mean?
Well, it all depends. There are 12 tribes, and normally the tribe Yosef is a tribe. It happens to be one tribe. It happens to be only for purposes of land division.
Right.
Yosef is divided into two tribes because Levi didn't get land. So the way it works is, whenever you are discussing the division of land, you always count Yosef as two, Ephraim and Manasseh. But whenever you're not talking about land, we count Yosef as a single consolidate. We treat Ephraim and Manasseh as if they're one tribe.
And they left Egypt as one tribe?
Well, they left it as two tribes because the plan of the way they traveled in the desert was based on the land they would get in Eretz Israel.
And what's the Shevet Yosef? You said it's Shevet Yosef.
No. If you count Ephraim and Manasseh are Yosef's sons.
What does Shevet
mean? Oh, Shevet means tribe.
Ah, tribe.
No, it means tribe. Yeah. So sometimes we... If you're counting Levi, then you count Yosef as a Shevet. If you're not counting Levi, you don't count Yosef as a Shevet, you count Ephraim and Manasseh as a Shevet. So it'd be an interesting project, if any of you would be interested in being ma'ayin in this, to go through every mention of the 12 tribes in Tanakh. Because it'd be an interesting point. When do I count Levi and therefore consolidate Ephraim and Manasseh into Yosef? And when do I not count Levi, and therefore I treat Ephraim and Manasseh as two separate tribes? Because remember, you always have to be 12. 12 is our magic number. 12 is the cosmic number, but there are two different ways of counting the 12. Okay, and it depends on the context.
Why Levi? Why Yosef and Levi? Why Levi?
No, the reason is because Levi is the tribe of the Kohanim and those who serve God. So they did not get a share of land in the land of Israel.
How didn't they get a share of land?
Because Hashem wanted them to focus totally on spirituality and not be involved in agricultural work.
So where did they live?
No, they were given cities. They were given cities, but they were not given... In other words, they lived within other tribal areas. So it's like, you didn't want Levi to be one area. You wanted the rabbis, the teachers, the tzaddikim, to be scattered throughout all of Am Yisrael. So the Levium lived in every tribe. Every tribe had an enclave of Levium.
They didn't live within just Yehuda?
Absolutely not. No. I mean, after the 10 tribes were exiled, they happened to live there. But originally, they lived in all twelve tribes. In other words, Eretz Yisrael was divided tribally. There was the territory of Yehuda, the territory of Yisachar, the territory of Zebulun. But there was no territory called Levi territory. Because we wanted every single tribe to have Levim. So there were cities Levim had. Now the logic of that is pretty clear. You don't want to have like all of the tzaddikim. No, this is the tribe of tzaddikim. No, you want the tzaddikim to be all over the place, right? So as a result, Shevet Levi was not given a portion. So that's what I'm saying. Sometimes when the Torah lists the 12 tribes, it doesn't count lay because it's talking about tribal portions. But the way you get 12 is it counts Ephraim and Manasseh as two.
Because female levies could marry other tribes.
Yes, they could. They could. They could. There was never a prohibition against one Jew marrying another Jew. So Kohanim could marry and female Kohen, Bas Kohens could marry anybody and the like. Okay.
So
now,
Levies from the Kohen, we consider them Levies, like.
Yes, all Kohanim are Levium. Now, a Levi, as you know, is a broader category than Kohen.
Right.
So not all. Right. Every Kohen is also a Levi, but obviously not every Levi is a Kohen. Right, because the first Kohen was Aaron. Aaron is a Kohen, Moshe is a Levi. Happens to be the only case where two brothers, right? One brother is a Kohen, one brother is a Levi, because God chose Aaron to be the Kohen. So from then on, Aaron's descendants are Kohanim.
Is that after the Exodus?
Well, it is after the Exodus. In fact, it was in last week's Parsha. Aaron is chosen as the Kohen in last week's Parsha. Now, you do remember, Chazal have a teaching that it was God's original plan that he wanted to make Moshe the Kohen also, instead of Aaron. But because Moshe was so reluctant, he kept on turning down God's offers with the at the burning bush, Hashem took the kahuna away from Moshe and gave it to Aaron. So it should have been Moshe's, but God divided it because Moshe, as a punishment to Moshe, for not accepting Hashem's mission. Yeah.
So Hoshua was a Kohen?
Absolutely not. Yeshua was not.
Lady.
No, he was not. Yeshua was from the tribe of Ephraim. He was not a Kohen or a Levi. He was Moshe's... the leadership of Am Yisrael was not hereditary from Moshe. In other words, Yeshua was not related to Moshe. But he was considered to be the most qualified to be a successor. Now, before we break, we'll talk about this tomorrow, I just want to mention one thing that people get confused. There is something in addition to all of this that is called the Urim V'Tumim. And if any of you have attended Yale University, you may even know that the motto of Yale University in Hebrew letters, is Urim V'Tumim. You know, in colonial times, in fact, they were doing it in some of the Ivy League schools until like 1970, the official languages of instruction were Latin, Classical Greek, and English. And you were expected to know Latin and Classical Greek, as well as Hebrew. As you mentioned, Hebrew as well. Thomas Jefferson knew Hebrew. A cultured, educated person. In fact, there was even a proposal, this may be an urban legend, but they say that when the Continental Congress decided to declare independence from England, there was such a strong anti-British sentiment that there were many people who did not want English to be the official language of the United States. They wanted a break from England. So one of the proposals was, let's make Hebrew the official language of the United States. Imagine that, because educated people in colonial times did know Hebrew. That's why Yale University's motto is in Hebrew, Urim V'Tumim.
What does that mean?
Urim V'Tumim literally means the complete light. It Urim is Lashon of Or, light.
And Tumim?
Tumim is Tamim, perfect, okay. Perfect. Now, legend has it that this proposal was defeated by one vote. If there would have been one extra vote, that would have been, Hebrew would have been the language of the United States. Now, in the early 20th century, people were discussing what should the language of Israel be. Most people didn't know Hebrew. Hebrew was not a spoken language. Hebrew did not have a vocabulary for science and the like. So there were some academics who felt Hebrew was not appropriate as the language of a modern society. So one of the proposals was, maybe English ought to be the official language of Israel. That got defeated. So imagine this, if history would have been different, you would be coming to Har Samech and struggling to try to learn English, right? To be able to talk in the street. You know, Hebrew, Of course, Baruch Hashem, I mean, since our Sifrei Kodesh are in Hebrew, then that would have given us an immeasurable advantage. But at least to understand the street conversation. Oh, gee, that English is... I just can't get, you know, that Israeli English, you know. I wish they would talk Hebrew. You know, so you never know. So history has some of these odd highlights. Now, the Urim V'Tumim was a prophetic device in which the Kohen Gadol served as a kind of prophet, in which God would be asked questions and the answer would be given by the lights of the letters, right? There are letters, right, engraved with the names of the tribes, and the letters would light up giving answers. The letters, you know, Cain, Lo, etc. And the Kohen would be able to communicate answers from Hashem. And that is called Urim V'Tumim. Now, so therefore, keep in mind the following. The Urim V'Tumim is not the same as the Choshen. One way of looking at it is, the Choshen and the jewels are the hardware. But the Urim V'Tumim, I'm using an irreverent phrase, was the software package. It was a piece of parchment that had various names of God. And that parchment was inserted between the folds of the Choshen, because the Choshen was embroidered, but it was folded. The jewels were in the front, but there was a fold. The Urim V'Tumim was the software package that was put inside of the Choshen, and that enabled the jewels of the Choshen to be a prophetic medium to communicate messages from God. So people are confused. The Urim V'Tumim was not the same as the Choshen. Thus, when the Mishnah says, during the Second Temple, we did not have the Urim V'Tumim, it does not mean we didn't have the Choshen. The Kohen Gadol during the Second Temple still wore the breastplate and still had the jewels. But it means that since we lost the gift of prophecy in the Second Temple, there were no prophets in the Bayis Sheni, so we lost the capacity of the Urim V'Tumim. Maybe we even had the software, so to speak, but it didn't work to give prophetic answers. Okay, so again, it's a very common misconception that people say there was no breastplate in the Second Temple. That is incorrect. It didn't have its prophetic capacity, but it still existed. Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about the Urim V'Tumim. So again, Urim V'Tumim. Urim is light, Lashon of Or. Tumim is Tamim, perfect. Perfect light. By the lighting up of the letters, answers and prophecies were communicated. Okay, we'll see you tomorrow. Yeah.